Hey, this is Ox from Dry Fire Training Cards, and today I've got with me Dusty Solomon from IS Solutions. Dusty is the author of what I think is one of the best, if not the best, books on training shooters, and it's called Building Shooters. And in it, Dusty goes into a lot of accelerated learning techniques for developing skills that you can use in extreme stress situations way, way faster than the traditional firearms training model. So, welcome, Dusty.
Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Absolutely. Do you mind going into your background a little bit and how you ended up getting to the position where you had all the information to write Building Shooters?
Sure. So, kind of the real base background, I went to the Naval Academy and was on the combat pistol team there. So, that kind of gave me a unique opportunity to develop a relatively high level of functional skill set with handguns, you know, when I was still in college. And then when I got out into the fleet, in full disclosure here, I did go to BUDS and did not make it through. But when I got into the fleet, I went into the regular Navy, right? I wasn't in Special Forces. I wasn't in, you know, any kind of elite unit or anything like that. And so that put me in a situation where I had a kind of a unique skill set with respect to small arms in an environment where quite frankly, most armed professionals find themselves, where there wasn't enough or really any, you know, training resources. We didn't have ranges. We didn't hardly have any ammunition and that kind of thing. So in 2000, 2001, 2002, I was on a U.S. Navy frigate as the gunnery officer and then later the force protection officer. So I was in charge of firearms, was in charge of all the small arms training. And again, had sort of this unique skill set, and this coincided right with the time when the Navy decided it needed to start getting serious about small arms training and about loading the guns and about security, which obviously took place in the, you know, kind of aftermath of the USS Cole or the attack on the USS Cole. You know, when Navy brass realized that the sailors in that situation didn't even have loaded guns, they kind of realized maybe that they needed to start making some changes. And So kind of being in that situation where all of a sudden I had, you know, about 200 to 250 people that I needed to train and realized I didn't have access to a range. I didn't have access to ammo. I think I had, you know, my allowance for the year was something like 10 to 15 rounds per person.
Wow.
Or something like that, which is obviously, you know, not enough to do really to do much of anything. And then, you know, I was also kind of dealing with a corporate mentality in the Navy where there have been several decades at least where, you know, your qualification on small arms was, you know, a gunner's mate would load the gun for you, hand it to you, shoot five rounds off a fantail, and if you hit the ocean, you qualify. And that was just sort of the level of understanding, right? So I remember having when I was trying to build this training program, and I was getting some pushback from, you know, from some of the other folks at the command, and I had a discussion with RXO a couple of days later, and he was like, or executive officer, you know, where I was talking to him when I was on watch up on the bridge, and he was like, you know, after you were talking the other day and kind of going through your plan, you know, he's like, my initial thought was, well, I don't need any of this stuff. You know, I know what I'm doing. I don't have a problem hitting the targets. He's like, and then I stopped and thought about it, and I realized I've never actually loaded a gun. Somebody else always loads it for me. And I realized further, right, again, and this is a senior combat officer, right? He's like, and I realized further, I don't think I could. I don't think I could load one of these rifles. I don't know how to do it. Like, he's like, until you gave this talk about what you wanted to do, I was confident in my ability with small arms. I realized I don't know how to load and unload the thing.
That's amazing.
You know, and yeah, well, and so that's just kind of the situation that we really found ourselves in corporately in the Navy because of, you know, sort of what our approach had been. So, anyway, so I, you know, running into these kind of challenges and these kinds of resources, I basically did the best that I could. It wasn't what I wanted to do, but, you know, not having range access, not having enough ammunition, you know, I put together kind of the best I could with a dry fire, you know, program that started with just teaching people to load and unload with dummy rounds and then go forward from there. The next command that I went to after leaving the ship was the Mobile Security Detachments on the East Coast, which was a new command. and it was the Navy's response to the USS Cole. When I got there, I was able to justify and sort of procure what we would consider to be more of a standard training package, kind of like even nowadays what we consider sort of standard, you know, training or shooting packages. High round counts, really intensive, you know, having people out there all day from, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock at night shooting till their, you know, hands were bleeding kind of thing. And what I started realizing when I got people into this advanced training block that I ran, you know, and sort of got to the end of it was that I wasn't really getting necessarily the bang for the buck that I wanted to. And it's not that people weren't, you know, in that environment weren't performing a little bit better than the guys on the ship, but it really wasn't significant. And so that really got me thinking about, you know, if I don't have a massive difference in performance from when I had no resources to where now I have a lot of resources and I've got guys that are at the security specific command, they're all, you know, for the most part, you know, military police already, right? So they've already been qualified. They've already been through every, you know, shooting school that the regular Navy has. They've already been through a package with weapons training battalion at Quantico. And now I've got them in this, you know, week-long intensive program. And after all that, you know, effort and training and money and resources pumped into these guys by, you know, the Navy, I'm not that much farther ahead than I was when I, you know, had 10 rounds per person. Maybe I need to look at fundamentally what I was doing in that environment, even though at the time I didn't think it was very good, and try to figure out what's going on from a training perspective. So that's kind of the background on how this whole project started.
Good deal. I came at it from a very, very different direction, but I had the similar limitation of time and money that made me just dive into dry fire and accelerated learning techniques and figure out how to keep improving when I didn't have the money for high round counts. And it's amazing what that stress or pressure, the diamonds it can create, for lack of a better term.
Right. Well, it's necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Mm-hmm. So how did you go from that experience to developing the sealed mindset curriculum with Larry and then writing Building Shooters?
Kind of after I got out of the Navy, I spent, you know, I was working in the security industry for a while, and, you know, in my spare time, I was trying to work on sort of continuing the research and refine these training methods. You know, when I had time off, I'd find people that, you know, wanted to learn, I'd train them, you know, was working on training on my own, and just kind of continuing to tweak this concept of, you know, how do I, or how can we as an industry deliver training in a way that's more effective? You know, because I know that most people are not, you know, most people are not special forces guys, right? Most people that carry a gun for a living they just don't have access to enough training or resources to really be effective, at least not within the organizationally provided structure, right? So,
mm-hmm.
Having personally felt that frustration as a trainer, and not just as a trainer, because I was the trainer and I was also the operational leader, you know, in most cases, at least when I was in the military, where it's like, I'm responsible for these guys. I'm responsible for making sure that they're prepared to, you know, go do their job or do a boarding or go into combat or, you know, whatever. And I don't have the tools to deal with that. That's very, very frustrating. And it's a situation that most people who work with armed professionals find themselves in. So it's kind of been something that's been, a passion of mine since being put in that position myself, is how can I help other people deal with these same problems effectively, and how can we kind of change what we do across the industry, you know, to more effectively train armed professionals. So as I started working on this, I remember talking to Larry, I guess this is about a year, before we decided to start Sealed Mindset, and I said, hey, you know, I've got this training program that I've been working on. I've got it, you know, outlined, and, you know, what do you think? And I just basically had asked him to take a look at it. You know, as we were both on the shooting team at the academy, and obviously he's a guy with, you know, a lot of operational experience. And as we were sitting and talking about this one day, when he was actually running a training program for me and another guy for work for some other stuff, and he said, you know, I think I've got a business idea with this. Like, I think this is something people would be interested in. And for me at the time, I wasn't, wasn't really interested in doing anything with it on the business side. So I said, hey, you know, if this curriculum's going to work for you and you think you can do something with it, you know, kind of have at it. And so that, you know, that just kind of advanced over the course of the next year. You know, I took the curriculum, refined it, and went and put together like a group of test students for a curriculum validation, you know, that had varying levels of experience from, you know, a lot of experience to zero experience. So I could get kind of varying levels of feedback, and then made some tweaks, and then put together what was the, you know, kind of the initial curriculum for Sealed Mindset. One of the things that we found with Sealed Mindset, and this was really before I had gotten into any of the brain science research, we just had a curriculum that we knew was effective because we, you know, I'd been doing it for, at that point, about a decade in some form or another, you know, while I was continuing to refine it. And then we had our, you know, kind of our body of test students and the feedback from them. So we knew that it worked. One of the things that we found is that it was interesting going into the civilian market with this, which isn't really what it was designed for, right? It was designed more for an organizational environment. We thought it would be something that would be real applicable to the civilian market, but people are so used to seeing, you know, kind of the traditional high resource, high round count, you know, real intensive day or 2 day or 3 day or 4 or 5 day, whatever, training periods. It's something that they just people didn't really understand, and they didn't particularly want to do it. And anyway, so that was kind of an interesting hiccup in our business plans, right? Where people were like, well, I don't understand why I would do this when I could just go to a 1 hour or a 1 day permit to carry class. You know, and it's very difficult to explain the difference, you know, to people that don't already know the difference, right?
I liken it to martial arts training versus going to fantasy camp.
Right. Yeah, no, it's exactly the same thing, right? Anyway, so I left the company, went back into the security industry, and you know, Larry continued on. And I guess it was maybe a year after I left Sealed Mindset, I did a course for a friend of mine who had moved to a rural area and wanted to do some shotgun stuff. And this friend of mine also happens to be a neuroscientist. And so I said, well, I can't really do, you know, I mean, I'll come out and do a 3 day course for you, and it won't really be, you know, using this learning system that I've developed, but, you know, I would like you to take a look at what I'm doing from the concept of how this would apply. So I basically did this demo course, and her feedback was, you know, you're really using some pretty cutting edge neuroscience, behavioral psychology stuff here that really nobody else is even talking about yet. So she gave me a, you know, kind of a couple of things to go look up on the science side. And so I started out to write a 5 to 10 page white paper about the science behind the training methods, and 200 pages later, I decided that something that was a little bit longer than a paper, and so that's what eventually turned into the book Building Shooters.
Good deal. Yeah, and it's like I said, it's an absolutely incredible book, very very valuable. Any serious instructor should have it and have it marked up and dog eared and be using it. It's very valuable.
But, well, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. I want to ask you a question. I forget how many years ago it was. Might have been 10 years ago. Might have been 15. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Outliers. He talked about it taking 10,000 hours or 10,000 repetitions for somebody to achieve mastery in any given skill. He recanted on that number a little bit, but would you mind talking about that a little bit and sharing how that fits in with your experiences with training large volumes of shooters?
Yeah, so I think first it's important to talk about what we mean by mastery. And this is just going to be personal opinion, right? But I think on a personal level, if anybody considers themselves to be a master at something, they're kind of deluding themselves, right? Because the moment that you stop being a student, then, you know, you kind of set yourself up for failure, I think. So when we're talking about, you know, we're talking about mastery, what we're really talking about is relative skill performance to what other people are doing. And so, you know, what your relative skill performance is to what other people are doing really depends on the other people that you're comparing yourself to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doesn't particularly apply to the unprofessional bit because what you're, you know, the only person that you're comparing yourself to that really matters is the person on the other end, you know, on the other side of the two-way range.
Right.
Should that moment ever, you know, ever arrive. For me, it's not about the number of hours or the number of repetitions or something, and nor really is it solely about what I'll call fundamental skill performance. Again, there's been a fair amount of social media flap about this recently, and I have a little blog and, you know, post stuff on Facebook nowadays, obviously because I've got the book out, but it's not, you know, I've never been a big social media hound, you know, with respect to this stuff, but I think people tend to get this next point confused, so I want to make sure that I explain the nuance here. So there is fundamental skill performance, right? So say, for example, and maybe a good example is the, you know, Chuck Taylor's Combat Master course, right, where you've got mm-hmm. a whole bunch of things that are, quite frankly, really, really difficult, right? So one of them is sub-second headshots from 5 yards, right, from the holster. So that's pretty quick, right? If you're going to be consistently making sub-second CS shots out of the holster, you have to have a very, very good draw stroke. So, you know, you could look at that standard and say, well, this is, you know, being able to meet the standard or meet these set of standards equates to mastery of the handgun. And you could make that argument, but at the same time, at any point during passing those standards on that course, or really, you know, any other course, are you required to make a decision on whether or not you need to shoot? Right?
Yeah.
So you can make an argument that somebody is a master-level handgunner, but they may not fundamentally be capable of even knowing whether or not they should draw their gun. Is that person a master? Is that person at that point a, you know, once we go to the point where the river meets the road, is that person a better or more masterful shooter than the guy that can only make a headshot 2 seconds from the same distance, but he makes the decision to draw a second and a half earlier and takes cover while he does it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think trying to define people or skills, particularly when we're talking about an organizational level, as, you know, whether someone has mastery or not, is maybe a little bit of a red herring. Or maybe not, you know, the approach we should necessarily be looking at, because what we want to do is we want to look at the full scope of what the operational requirement is, right? And this would apply not just to organizations, but also to folks that want to defend themselves. Look at the full scope of what the operational environment demands, what skills we need to apply, what brain functions need to be connected with those skills in the operational environment. So examples would be contextual association, stimulus recognition, right, cognitive processing, decision making, you know, skills performance feedback, and all those types of things. What are the brain functions that are going to be associated with and centered around these skills that we're performing? And then how do I take all this stuff and how do I put it into the correct memory system that allows me to get to it under stress, right? Allows me to get to it when I go sympathetic, or the sympathetic nervous system takes over, you know, as your primary controlling system. So I think when we're talking about mastery from a practical perspective, again, I don't really like the term, but that's really what we're talking about. And I don't think that you can define that for an operational performance area quite as, you know, discreetly as you can say for, you know, something like playing the violin or whatever, where maybe you don't have as many brain functions associated with it and certainly not as many variables.
Yeah, you make a great point about that in the book, about how defined standards a lot of times will drive people to use equipment and techniques that they'd never use in real life just to make the standard.
Right.
And
yep. Oh, yeah. There are some parts of the industry on the professional side where, in my opinion at least, it's a limiting factor, right? And in an effort to do something good, we've actually limited our performance potential in a way that doesn't necessarily help us downrange.
Mm-hmm. Great. So what hacks or factors have you found to have the biggest impact on shortcutting the process of, I guess, not mastery, which is the word that
right.
is central
right.
in my head, but
technical proficiency under stress?
Yeah, so there's a couple things here. So I think, you know, when I say that, and I talk about it in the book, right, like, hey, we can, you know, cut your training hours down, cut your ammunition requirements down, and produce a better shooter, right? And what does that sound like? It sounds like I'm selling bottles of pond water, you know, as some elixir on a, you know, on a cart somewhere. And so I think it's not so much that you're shortcutting, you know, the path to proficiency or the path to mastery or whatever, you know, whatever term we want to use. It's that you're taking a much different approach to putting those skills into the brain. So the analogy that I use in the book is the way that we train right now is essentially like, you know, you're standing 10 yards away from a glass with a misting sprinkler, right, or a hose that's mm-hmm. misting, and you're spraying water at this glass. And you'll eventually fill the glass up that way, right? Like, you're eventually going to put enough water in the glass. But, you know, you might have a 12-ounce glass, and you're going to spray 30 gallons of water out in the general direction before you finally fill it up. You know, so what we're doing with this, you know, method of training development, right, is, and you're never going to get to 100%. Like, no real world system works at 100% efficiency, right? Mm-hmm. But what we're saying is, hey, you know, maybe we can, you know, instead of using 30 gallons of water to fill up this 12-ounce glass, maybe we can use 24 ounces of water to fill up this 12-ounce glass, right? So it's not so much that we're taking a shortcut, we're just doing things much more efficiently. So instead of wasting 80 to 90% of our training time, which is kind of what our existing training paradigm does, particularly for entry-level, this is really applicable for entry-level folks who don't already have the skills, we're going in and we're trying to, as close as we can within the parameters of any real-world system, we're going in and we're using 100% of our training time such that it's effective. Right, which means that over the course, okay, so let me back up and use an example. Let's say that in an 8-hour day, because we're limited in a 24-hour period on how much new information we can learn. That's one of the things we mm-hmm. talk about in the book. Like, there's just some neurological limitations there based on the capacity of the short-term memory system. So let's say in an 8-hour day, right, or within a 24-hour period, I'm limited to, and I'm just going to throw a number out here, 45 minutes worth of instruction actually being learned. So mm-hmm. I take somebody, I put them in an 8-hour training day, and they retain, or they get 45 minutes worth of benefit out of that 8-hour training day. So now I bring them in for day 2, I give them a second 8-hour training day, they get another 45 minutes of benefit. All right, so now I bring them in for a third 8-hour training day, they're going to get another 45 minutes of benefit. So at this point, somebody's got, what, 2.25 hours or whatever of benefit, but I've put in 24 hours worth of effort to get them there.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Right, so yep. versus I bring somebody in and I give them 1 hour worth of training, and let's assume, just to keep the numbers easy, that I'm getting 1 hour worth of training and I'm going to get 45 minutes worth of benefit out of it because it's not a perfect system, right? So I bring him in one day, I give him 1 hour of training to get 45 minutes worth of benefit out of it. I bring him in the second day, I give him 1 hour worth of training to get 45 minutes worth of benefit. I bring him in the third day, I give him 1 hour of training, I give him 45 minutes worth of benefit. So, yeah, over the course of 3 days, I have, on the one hand, I've given somebody 24 hours worth of resources, and they've got, you know, 2.25 hours worth of benefit. On the other hand, I've put in 3 hours worth of resources, and they've gotten the same benefit out of it. From an organizational perspective, it's not so much that we're doing things, quote, you know, faster. Now, there is a little bit of faster to it, and we'll talk about that in a second. Right, but we're really streamlining our use of resources, and we're able to deliver this stuff a lot more efficiently. Okay, so that's one component. The second mm-hmm. component, which is where we really get to, I'll call a faster path to proficiency, or a faster path to, you know, a functional operational capability, or if you wanted to use the term mastery, we can use that. But when I, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is a term that we came up with to explain an effect that we see in training, which we call progressive interference. All right, so when yep. I try to put more information into the short-term memory system than can actually fit there, particularly when we're talking about skills that would occupy the same neural space, and I'm I'm giving people more than they can really, you know, develop proficiency in, and more than they can put in the long-term memory. You start doing these skills, but you're not doing them well. So grip is the example we use in the book, and this is something that where you commonly see this problem when you're teaching people, where you'll teach somebody to try to grip a handgun, and then you immediately take them out, and you have to start shooting, and then you have to start shooting multiple rounds, and then multiple rounds, multiple targets, and all right, well, now let's teach presentation. Now you're presenting from the holster. Well, presenting from the holster, in order to do that, you have to be able to grip the gun. Right, so now I've got somebody that doesn't have a consolidated grip, right, so the grip doesn't automatically happen, and now I'm having them try to do it under stress, under time pressure, while they're drawing the gun from the holster. So every time they grip the gun, it's going to end up being a little bit different. And so I'm never really developing a consolidated grip, right? I never really consolidate the grip. So basically, you can think of that like a corrupted data file, is kind of a good way to think of it. And so when we do that, right, I've now done this 24 hours. Let's say I use our traditional model where I do like a three-day class, and I get 2.25 hours worth of benefit out of my three-day class, right? So out of that 2.25 hours of benefit, a lot of that data that actually got saved is corrupted data, right? So the data file is not the file that I gave the person as the instructor, because the information got overwritten and they were performing the skill wrong, you know, when it's part of a progressive skill, or because they couldn't remember all the stuff, you know, the components of performance. And so now what I have is somebody who actually has consolidated, right, and they have put into their long-term memory system as a response to a stimulus, right, or as part of a bigger motion, right, there's a threat, I'm going to draw my gun and move or whatever. Well, they've got this corrupted data file that's associated with that skill. And so now if that person wants to achieve a level of proficiency, right, or achieve a level of mastery, they don't just have to go learn the skill. They don't just have to learn it. They have to unlearn, right, or they have to develop something that is stronger than that which was initially consolidated, right, and overcome these now competing skill performances that are in long-term memory that are in response to the same stimulus. Does that make sense, or am I going off the deep end here?
No, it makes sense. It's one way I explain it is like a if you've got a bag full of spaghetti,
right,
if they're all lined up together, it's way different than if you drop them on the counter.
Right.
And so one way you're going the same direction every single time with every single noodle, and the other way it's a little bit different every single time.
Right, and it just becomes a mess, right? So now if I want to – and so let's just use that, you know, sub-second headshots from the holster example, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to do that, you got to have a really good grip, right, which – so you're coming out, your sights are aligned with your dominant eye right out of the holster, your extension has to be perfect, you have to have a smooth trigger press. Having a smooth trigger press that's refined is going to be dependent on your hand being in the right position in relation to the trigger and the gun and all that stuff, right? Because you don't really have time to refine your sight picture there. So,
right.
So all that stuff has to be aligned perfectly, right? Well, if you grip the gun differently every single time, all of that stuff is going to be different every single time, which means you're never going to be able to develop a, you know, and let's just, again, I don't really like the term, but let's call that mastery of the draw stroke. Right, from a skill, discrete skill perspective, right? You're never going to be able to master surgical shooting from the draw stroke, because fundamentally what you're doing is different every single time, right? And probably none of it is biomechanically optimal, which is kind of what we're looking for. We want to maximize applied physics when we shoot. That's kind of the point of techniques. So if you don't have that, you're never going to be able to develop mastery until you get it. So if I take my time early on as an instructor, right, or in a training system, right, and let's say that it takes me 2 weeks of 1 hour a day of delivering training to somebody to get them to the point where they have procedurally consolidated all of these skills, right, so where their grip is the same every time, they're getting the sight picture, they have a smooth draw stroke with no hitches in it, everything is biomechanically correct. So let's say that takes 2 weeks of training using kind of a skill delivery, right, where we're doing 1 hour at a time, or whatever that looks like, right? We're delivering the skills that are in line with how the brain learns. So that is now 14, okay, let's just say it's 1 hour a day for 2 weeks, and we're training every day. So that's 14 hours of training effort that I've put into the student spread over a two-week time period. So in some ways, you could say, well, that's not very efficient because I can qualify somebody in 3 days. And I can give them, you know, to a certain point, all the skills that they need in 3 days. But somebody is not going to achieve mastery in that three-day period because of the effects of progressive interference, you know, because they're not really long-term, they're not consolidating the stuff in the long-term memory. So, yeah, at the end of this three-day period, you will have achieved a minimal performance standard on, you know, whatever it is that you're able to do in that three-day period. But somebody at that point has consolidated or they have learned, you know, some sort of corrupted technique that will never allow them to achieve mastery. Right, in order to achieve mastery, in order to be very, very good, they're going to have to go back and they're going to have to unlearn all of this stuff. So, you know, and then they're going to have to relearn everything. So if we think about the path to becoming highly skilled from a technical fundamental performance level, on the one hand, we say, well, we can pump somebody out in 3 days, right? So this is the best path because I can get somebody out in 3 days. But on the other hand, I'm saying, well, this takes me 2 weeks to get somebody proficient. However, I'm only investing 14 training hours, whereas in my 3 days, I'm investing 24 training hours, right? And in my 3 days, I've now speeded somebody's ability to ever achieve a very high level of skill because they're going to have to go back and fix all the stuff that they learned that was wrong, right, or that was suboptimal, maybe a better word than wrong, right, that's not biomechanically correct and their grip is wrong. Or, you know, they grip differently every time, or, you know, they have a flinch or whatever. Whereas if we deliver training in the way that the brain learns, we're investing less overall training hours, and now there's no impedance to enhancing yourself to a mastery level.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense from it being a more direct path?
Right. So I want to ask you about a phenomenon and see if you've got any feedback on it. Something that I see over and over and over again, and something that I experienced for years, people will go to a 2, 3, or 5 day class, and at the end of it, they'll be dialed in and shooting awesome. And within a matter of weeks, if not days, it tapers off very, very quickly, and the performance increases disappear.
Right.
Alternatively, when people take a frequent small block learning approach, it seems to stick longer.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Would you be able to explain what's going on there?
Yeah. So when we use this 3 to 5 day class approach, right, and what we'll do is we kind of justify what we're doing by using end of training period performance standards.
Yeah,
like you said,
exactly.
Yeah, that end of training period performance standard might be, you know, again, well, whatever it is, right? I've got this end of training period performance standard. The students are meeting it, and I can say, well, look how good these people are. I'm sending them out. But what we're seeing is that, and obviously anybody that has really trained people and then worked with them afterwards sees an incredibly sharp drop-off in skill performance immediately after the training period. So you're essentially getting a very low percentage of retention. And so neurologically, the reason that this happens is that when we're working in that kind of that compressed time frame, we're putting all the information into the short-term memory system, right? So we're training and we're performing everything out of short-term memory, but that information never goes to long-term memory. So when you retain something, right, when you actually learn something, that information has to be transferred into a different part of the brain, right? And so basically what we're talking about is no different than cramming for a test and then data dumping, which every single person has done because that's kind of the way our education system's set up, right? You go in, you study the test the night before, you memorize all this stuff, you're really familiar with it, you go in, you pass the test, 3 days later, you couldn't even begin to tell somebody what the test was about, much less, you know, all of the details that you put on it. And so that is basically the same phenomenon, but you're doing it with physical skills, right? The brain doesn't, yes, there are differences, right? But we're fundamentally talking about the same information in, you can perform information out of what's in short-term memory, and then the information goes away. So it's kind of like, a short-term memory is very much like a computer, right? So your computer has what's called random access memory, or RAM. And so you could have stuff that's in RAM that you're working with on your computer, say like in a data file, if you're working in a Word document, well, all that information might be there, but if you don't save it, it's going to go away. You know, if you just unplug mm-hmm. your computer, for those of us that remember back in the day when we didn't have laptops, right, you know, type in a school paper and somebody comes in and kicks the, you know, they got the National Lampoon's Fire Hazard string of power cords put together so that they can have all these computers mm-hmm. running. Somebody comes in and kicks it and you just spent, you know, 3 hours typing up your paper on the early, you know, early days word processors and the whole thing goes away because computer, you know, powered down. You know, and that's kind of, you know, and you hadn't saved it yet to your, you know, 4-inch floppy disk or whatever. I don't even, yeah, what was it, the 6-inch disk? You know what I'm talking about, those big floppy disks.
Yeah, what was
so,
it, 3.5 and 5.25?
Yeah, whatever it was, the ones were actually soft.
were
actually
those were the
floppy.
5.25.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and then they got high-tech with the sliding door.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, anyway, so that's kind of what we're talking about, right? This information is there. You can access it. You can play with it. You can do stuff with it. But it never gets put into one of the long-term storage systems in your brain. And so it basically kind of immediately goes away. Now, when you're using the, you know, shorter training blocks, but what you're doing is you're putting a little bit of information into the brain, and then you back away from it, and you allow your brain to do the things that it needs to do to store it. So one of the things we talked about in the book, and we you know, kind of outline a bunch of the science behind it and reference the studies and all that, is that if you want information to be retained, you got to put it in the short-term memory, and then you got to leave it alone for about 24 hours, right? Not access it, not play with it again, not repeat it. It has to be that there's all these processes that the brain has to do to put it in long-term memory. And some of those happen when you're awake. Some of them can only happen when you're asleep. And so, you know, when you do that shorter training period approach, basically what you're doing is you're giving the brain information in a way that the brain is capable of putting it into the long-term memory system. You know, whereas when you do this compressed three-day approach, your brain's just not capable of retaining it.
Mm-hmm. So kind of with that in mind, what's the best time of day to do your training?
Well, one of the things that we looked at in the book, and this is something we, you know, a lot of what's in the book is really the basic training methodology we know works, right? I know I've been teaching that way now for actually a couple of decades, I guess, at this point almost, or a decade and a half, I guess. You know, but it, again, like I said, it started out as a 5-to-10-page paper and then kind of grew from there. And I was like, wow, like this really explains some other stuff that I've seen or whatever. So this is one thing I haven't had a chance to do any actual real scientific research on, but some of the basic neuroscience data shows that it's going to be, it will be better to do your teaching in the afternoon because it's going to get that offline waking time and offline sleep time both within that 12-to-24-hour period right after training.
Mm-hmm. And that's for learning. Is refinement the same? Or
yeah, correct.
Are there fewer limitations?
Well, what's that?
Or are there fewer limitations on refinement?
On what? Skill enhancement?
Cycle.
Skill enhancement seems to have less restrictions on it. Because you're working in a different part of the brain, right? So understand what you're doing when you're learning, right? So when you learn something, you're taking new information, you're putting it into the short-term memory system, and then your brain has to take that information that's in short-term memory, has to recognize that it's important enough to be stored, and it has to take it and it has to put it into a different part of the brain, right? So now when you're working on enhancement, you're taking information that's already stored in the long-term memory system. You're working with that, then you're essentially reconsolidating it within long-term memory. And those are different processes. So there's a much less effects of interference, and some of the sleep processes seem to be a little bit different. But I didn't do a ton of research about that, and to be honest with you, I don't think that the research has even been done.
Okay.
In terms of really
or it hasn't been done in
down,
large
but,
enough.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think neuroscience has approached that. It doesn't really have an answer to that question right now, as far as I know.
Do you know if there's been any studies on which stage of sleep has the most impact on consolidating and transferring information from short-term to long-term procedural memory?
Yeah, well, so it depends, right? So, like I said, you need both waking and sleep offline time. And so we have to understand when we start talking about this stuff, right? And I'm not a neuroscientist. Let me say that. I'm not claiming to be, right? But we're talking about a system that is, you know, virtually infinitely complex when we start talking about the brain and how it processes information, right? So, what we try to do in building shooters is create a very simple, functional working model of how the brain works so that we can, you know, sort of predict its behavior as an information system and then work within its capabilities when we're training. So, now as it relates to, at least my understanding from the research that I've done on how this works, right, there are very, there are a lot of different facets to information, right? So, for example, it appears that the actual physical motor skill performance is mostly consolidated during your waking period, but the intent and the goal of that is what's consolidated during the sleep period, right? So that's just one example.
Wow.
But then even if you get down into, you know, intent, right, there may be different components of intent, right? So, for example, there may be, you know, a visual motor component of it, which is consolidated during one part of sleep, right? And then there may be a, you know, some other part which consolidated during a different part of sleep. So I'm not going to pretend that I can go through and talk about all that because I can't.
Okay.
But it's one of those things that we need to understand that, really, even folks that are neuroscientists and do this stuff for a living and are specifically studying this will tell you that they're, you know, we're really in the fledgling stages of being able to understand it, and we really don't even have the tools. We've gotten a lot better tools in the last 5 years, but we really don't even have the tools to analyze how this stuff works yet. Still kind of in the fledgling scientific stages of beginning to understand how some of these processes work in the brain.
In the book, you tell a fascinating story about the limits of short-term memory, specifically loading and unloading a pistol. Would you mind sharing that?
Yeah, well, so this is actually more about retention, and it kind of goes back to the thing you just talked about, right, where you put somebody through this 3-day class, they finish good at the end, and then a week later, they're struggling to perform some of the skills at a fundamental level. So this is, I guess, a year and a half ago. You know, I kind of will routinely go and take training through other people and that kind of thing, keep up a couple instructor certifications. And, of course, it's always good to go learn, right? The day we stop being stupid, it's kind of over. So I went and just took a one day, or I guess it was a half day defensive pistol class here at a local range near where I live. And so starting in the class, like I said, there was me, and I think there were 3 or 4 other people in the class. Everybody had their carry permits, and 2 of the other people had been through multiple, you know, quote unquote defensive handgun classes over the previous 6 months. So we started the class. The instructor very prudently, it was a good idea. He said, hey, you know, no live ammo in the classroom, and now let's start with, you know, just kind of how we load and unload the gun with dummy rounds. I was the only person who could load and unload my gun without assistance when we started the class. Right, and so you go back and you think about that, and you're like, all these people have carry permits, and 2 of them have been to advanced, you know, not advanced, but they've been to defensive handgun classes, like 2 of them, within the previous 6 months, yet we're back at the point where we're struggling to even load the gun, right, with dummy rounds in the classroom. And so, again, that's not so much a, you know, indictment of the instructor. And this is one of the things I talked about with Mike Seeklander in the interview we did a couple weeks back. You know, at a certain point as an instructor, it's not so much even what you're teaching if the training system doesn't allow the student to learn it, right? Like, you can give them the best information in the world, but if the data becomes corrupted because of the delivery method or the training system that you used, or the student can't retain what you taught them, not because what you taught them was bad, not because you're not a good instructor, but because your system of delivering the information doesn't facilitate learning, you spend a lot of time spinning your wheels. And that kind of comes back to what we talked about before of what's the quickest path to, you know, path to mastery or path to proficiency. And particularly looking at it from the instructor angle, which is really where I'm focused in the industry right now, is civilian organization, right? But in an organizational environment, if I want to take this body of people or this group of people, and I want to make them capable and competent and able to perform in the operational environment, when I spend 80% of my time delivering information in a way that the students just can't learn it, then I'm kind of spinning my wheels. So why don't we restructure the system so that I'm giving people information in a way that they're going to be able to learn it, right? And kind of functionally, naturally learn the data based on the training system.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Another one of the fascinating things that you touch on in the book is how important it is to wait 24 hours between learning sessions, and specifically that you may not be able to perform something that you just learned if you try it. I think it was 4 to 6 hours later.
Well, it's not that you won't be able to perform it, but it's during that time period when your brain, if it thinks this information is important enough to store, is doing the transfer process where it's moving it to long-term memory, right? And when you do this, it involves all kinds of stuff like protein synthesis and extending dendrites and, right, myelination and all kinds of these chemical processes that are happening in the brain. But when you go in there and kind of reaccess that circuit, it can interrupt or interfere with that, those biological processes. So as a general rule, it seems, you know, the literature seems to say that you've got about 24 hours where information is very subject to being interfered with, right, which can impact your ability to retain it. So typically want to have about a 24-hour period between training sessions, which gives the brain time to transfer and stabilize that information.
Excellent. So I'm going to have a package available from this page where people can get Building Shooters and Concealed Carry Master's Course together.
Okay.
But if people want to buy the book on their own, where's the best place for them to go to get it?
Yeah, so you can go to Amazon and find Building Shooters. That's probably the best place to buy it. Or if you want to read, I've got a blog, which is buildingshooters.com, particularly if you're an instructor at an organizational level that's sort of focused on those kind of issues. And it's, you know, intended to be original content that's at least hopefully going to be of help to a professional instructor.
That's awesome. Well, before we go, do you have anything else that you'd like to add or mention?
No, I mean, I just kind of want to thank you for doing this. Like, I'm, you know, pretty excited. I've had a really good response to the book so far, which is pretty exciting. And it's always nice when you kind of write something like that and you get off in sort of your own world, right? And I spent 2 years reading neuroscience papers and typing. And then at the end of it, it's like, is this going to make sense to anybody but me? So it's nice to have folks, you know, other folks around the industry, you know, who kind of read the book or look at the book that are sending me emails or calling or whatever and being like, hey, like, this is explaining a whole bunch of stuff I've been seeing for years, you know, or wow, this makes sense, right? I'm making, you know, like I got a law enforcement trainer that runs an academy, right, who read the book and he sent me an email and said, I just read your book and I just changed our curriculum, right, because I realized what we're doing, you know, that we've got a major problem with how we're delivering information, so we're changing it. You know, so stuff like that's pretty cool to see that, you know, maybe we're able to, you know, and that's always been the goal for me. Like, you know, it's cool to have the ability to kind of make a little cash or whatever doing this. But for me, it's primarily been about how do we change the industry and make it more efficient, particularly for the, you know, the armed professionals that are really kind of put in a bad position just by, I've got this job to do and, you know, I'm an instructor and I've got to train all these people and I've, you know, most people are in the same situation I was almost always in, which is I don't have the resources to do my job. You know, so that's, and that's really what this project is about for me is how can we change our approach across the industry, put better performers on the street, help people make better decisions and help trainers facilitate that in environments where they don't have access to every potential resource they could want because they're never going to, and that's just the reality. Yeah, anyway, so that's it. Go ahead, sorry.
I wanted to ask you something on that. You mentioned the police academy instructor. One of the biggest problems that I've heard, I've talked with a handful of other instructors who have read Building Shooters and love Building Shooters, and the common problem that they had was figuring out how to implement it when they're kind of hindered by institutional memory either in their training company or in their department. Do you have any suggestions for
instructors who can't completely dive in to use some of the concepts in their training when they are hampered by bureaucratic processes or institutional memory in how some people think training should be done?
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you, that is a huge problem.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is. And I actually just put out a blog today called Training as a Leadership Tool, and you know, I forget exactly what the name of it was, but it's basically about how training is an invaluable leadership tool. And I talk about some examples in there, right, where if you're able to go out there and you're able to, as an operational leader, make your people handle firearms, see what they're doing, see where there's a problem, right, you're in a position to be able to intervene in some of these, you know, potential situations where you got somebody out there that maybe doesn't really have the skill set to make good decisions and, you know, make a good shoot decision or handle the gun appropriately. But that's not how we approach training in the industry, right? So, and it's not been the, or at least not on our professional side, because we kind of outsource everything to either a training department or to contractors. And then the operational supervision is left with responsibility for operational outcomes where they have no tools to influence.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you don't have support as an instructor, and I have certainly been in, I've been in situations where I had, you know, kind of the flexibility to make my own decisions, and I've been, designed my training system, and I've been in situations where I did, and it can be very, very frustrating. So here's what I would say to instructors that are kind of in that, you know, kind of in that boat, is don't get so wrapped around the need for resources, and don't think that just because you don't have access to this and such a resource that it means that you can't do something that's effective. So, for example, one of the jobs I had, I was able to do what was actually some very effective use of force training, like, you know, functional scenario-based use of force training in an environment where we didn't have anything. And I was able to do that simply by basically using 8.5 by 11 paper and sort of writing down, this is what this person's doing, right? And just in having them hold it up, right? And I'm putting a guy in a scenario where he's got to make decisions. And yeah, he's not going through all the motor mechanics of shooting because I wasn't able to do that, but at least I'm putting somebody in a situation where I'm exercising all the other components, right? And now I'm, as a leader, able to evaluate and say, hey, you know what, we're making good decisions or we're not making good decisions. And I'm able to make people exercise all those thought processes, right? And I'm able to do it in a pretty short time period too. You know, I think kind of my goal there with the guys was, I'm going to do a scenario and the entire thing from beginning to finish in the debrief is going to take less than 5 minutes. And I got a ton of pushback because nobody wanted to do it and they were really upset and they, you know, I don't want to have to deal with this. You say it's going to take 5 minutes, but I know it's going to take 45 minutes and it's going to be a mess. It's going to get in the way of our other duties. And so I did the first one, and one of my guys, who was a very experienced guy operationally, grabbed me afterwards. He's like, yeah, you said it was going to take 5 minutes, and I thought it was going to take a half hour. He's like, but that actually only took 5 minutes. And it was like really beneficial. I was like, well, yeah. And so there are things that you can do that, that will be functional, will be helpful, and, you know, don't think that, you know, just because I don't have access to resources that I can't do something. So that'd be the first thing. The second thing is, we're trying to work here to make some changes about how the industry approaches this kind of stuff, you know, and of course, find the buck. But, no, I mean, if you can go to your, you know, kind of go to your administration or go to your department and not just say, this is what I want to do, you know, but this is what I want to do and this is why and this is the science behind why this works, right? I'm not just telling you that I want to do this stuff, but I want to do this stuff for these reasons, and here's the brain science behind how this works, right? And obviously we provided that in the book, not just our interpretation of it, but all the science is there. You know, you can look at the resources and pull the actual materials that we got this stuff from. You may find people to be a little bit more receptive to that, especially when you can justify it, not just from the perspective of, hey, we might be able to improve performance here, but you're also able to improve performance without going in and asking people for more resources, right? That's usually where the immediate breakdown is when a trainer walks in to talk to an administrator, because the administrator knows what's coming, right? The administrator knows that he's going to be asked to shell out some more cash, and a lot of times people will immediately turn off, right? Like, I'm not even going to listen to what you have to say because I'm already, you know, over budget for the year, right? So don't even talk to me. So if you can kind of couch that from the beginning, and I'm not promising anyone this will work, but hey, look, I'm actually talking about maybe even over the long term reducing our training budget, here, right? If we start looking at how we're delivering these skills, we'll be able to do it more effectively, and we'll be able to really functionally mitigate some of these issues that law enforcement's failing, or not failing in, but certainly that are a challenge for law enforcement right now, right? And maybe even reduce our organizational liability by being able to say, hey, we've been able to train in low light, and we do 3 times a week, we do a use of force, like a functional use of force scenario, and we're, you know, our guys are doing whatever it is, the training program that you come up with. And you should be able to implement a lot of that stuff without really needing any resources. You know, you should have everything that you know, ready. You're not adding costs. You're not adding resources. So some of that stuff may, you know, may help if you couch it from the perspective of, hey, we're looking at reducing cost, improving performance, and reducing liability in our operation. Right. At that point, it becomes a little bit more difficult for someone to come back and argue. And I'm speaking now from the, you know, have been in the administrative management side of this as well. Right, if somebody comes to you and gives you a professional presentation as a trainer saying, hey, this is what I would like to do, this is what I'd like to implement with my guys, and here's why, right? Here's the science behind it. We're going to reduce our costs potentially. We're certainly not going to add costs. We're going to reduce our liability, and we're going to improve our performance. Right, if the administrator comes back and is like, nope, we're not going to do this, at some point there's going to be a question about why that decision was made, particularly if something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So let me get this straight. You decided that you didn't want to improve the performance of your officers or security guards or whatever, even though it wasn't going to cost you anything. And then, you know, this and such a thing happened. Why is that? So those are the kind of things that, you know, administrators and you know, senior level managers will also think about at some point. So anyway, so that would be the some of the things I'd think about if, for folks in administrative or, you know, an administrative environment, but in an organizational setting that are getting some pushback to make some changes.
Excellent. All right. Well, hey, thank you very much, Dustin. And again, you can go to buildingshooters.com or the, I'll have links on the page, but buildingshooters.com or go to amazon.com and look up Building Shooters. And thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.